My next guest has embarked on the self-help book market, but he's not trying to convince you to change your life through diet or psychology or religion. Instead, he wants you to go back in time before you go forward. Roman Krznarek believes that the study of history can teach us about how to live now. Roman is a cultural thinker and advisor from the School of Life in London, and his new book is called The Wonder Box, subtitled Curious Histories of How to Live. Roman, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, what is the wonder box of the title?
Well, in the Renaissance, there was this idea that you would collect fascinating objects and put them in a curiosity cabinet or a wonder box, and each of those objects would have a great story to tell. And I think history is exactly the same. It's full of fantastic stories and ideas from the past that we can actually use to improve our lives today, like, for instance, the idea that the ancient Greeks had six different words for love. That can help us with our romantic dilemmas.
So the wonder box, I mean, some people do have a modern-day version of a wonder box. If they are much travelled, for example, they might bring back a carving from Africa, and then maybe a grandchild would say, Grandad, where did that come from? And there's a story.
That's right. And equally, we've got stories from individuals in the past that we can look to. So, for example, there was a fantastic Japanese poet called Basho in the 17th century, who is an object in the wonder box, who reinvented the art of travel. He said that we ought to make pilgrimages to places that are personally meaningful to us. So, for example, this year, instead of lying in the sun on your holiday, go to the village where your grandmother was born instead and see the street she played in as a child. That's what I think's in the wonder box of history.
Mm. And I suppose you could even take off your shoes and socks and walk the streets as she might have done barefoot.
Absolutely. You have to wear a pair of straw sandals to do it in Basho's style.
Mm. Now, you go back to the ancient Greeks, and you say they actually discussed six different types of love. And what are the lessons? First of all, what are the different types, and how could we employ that kind of wisdom today?
Well, if you think about how we use the word love today, we use it in an incredibly vague way. We'll sign an email, lots of love, yet whisper I love you over a romantic meal. Now, the Greeks would have thought we were incredibly crude because they had these six different words for love that they used for different kinds of relationship. So there was eros, which was their word for sexual passion and desire. But they thought even more important was another kind of love, which was called philia, which was about friendship. And that's about developing deep emotional links with your friends, about sacrifice and loyalty. There was another love called agape, which was selfless love, a love of strangers. And it's from agape that, translated into Latin, became our word caritas or charity. And the Greeks would say, you're ridiculous trying to look for a soulmate who can satisfy all of your loving needs and be both a friend and a lover and someone you can have children with and someone you could grow old with. You need to spread the love and nurture different kinds of love with different people, with lovers and friends and even with strangers.
Ludus, a playful affection, for example, between children or casual lovers.
That's right. That's the Greek idea of playful love is one that we know in our relationships when we're falling in love, they're full of a playful flirtation. Or equally, you can experience that ludic love when you're down at the pub with your friends, bantering with your mates, laughing and joking with them. And I think that's one we need to cultivate more in our lives. I mean, certainly me, the one that I'm missing is that the ludic idea of dancing with strangers, which can be, in a way, a substitute for sex itself. I think we all need a little bit more frivolity and ludus in our lives.
And what about pragma in our lives?
Well, pragma is the ancient Greek idea for mature love, the kind of love that develops between a long married couple, which is about compromise and making a relationship work through time. And I think the ancient Greeks would have thought this is something we're really missing today. You know, if you get married today, there's a 50% chance you'll get divorced in the Western world, and there's a plague of short-term relationships. I think we need to learn to give love as well as receive it. In a way, we need to not just learn to fall in love, or not just fall in love, we need to learn to stand in love more and make love work through through a relationship.
We mentioned five of the six. We might as well mention the last one, philautia.
Yeah, philautia is the idea of self-love. Now, the Greeks were rather clever. They saw there were two kinds. One kind was a dark or a nasty kind of self-love, where we become narcissistic and self-obsessed. But there was also a virtuous kind, which was the idea that if you feel secure in yourself and you like yourself, you're going to have a lot of love to give others. And the philosopher Aristotle famously said that all fellow feeling for others is an extension of man's feeling for himself. And if you don't feel good about yourself, you're going to be pretty bitter and twisted. So we need a healthy dose of self-love in order to feel good about who we are.
So the lesson for today, you know, where someone complains that their love life is in bits, or that they've no love life at all, they're usually referring to sexual activity. But the rest of their life, in terms of love, parental love, the love of friends, the amount of ludus in their lives, the frivolity, the banter, the crackdown at the pub, they might be actually quite healthy.
That's right. I think it's a rather consoling thought to think there are lots of different kinds of love. If you are feeling miserable in your sort of sexual love life, you don't feel you've got a lot of eros going on, if you actually mapped out all the different kinds of loves that the Greeks talked about, you'd actually realize you had a lot more love than you previously imagined. And equally, I think we ask too much of our lovers in our relationships. We ask our sexual partners or wives or husbands to embody all these different kinds of love. And I think we need to seek them in other places. I think that's going to really improve the quality of our love lives in 2012.
Yeah, actually, in a real practical way, many people, and this is not really a gender issue because there are exceptions, but many lads would prefer to watch the match with a mate than with the missus.
Well, in a way, there's nothing wrong with watching the match, you know, with your mates, because in a way that can be a way of fostering or cultivating philia, which was the deep comradely friendship that developed between brothers in arms on the Greek battlefields. Now, of course, watching TV isn't like being on the battlefield together with somebody, but, you know, you develop a bond, and I think that kind of thing's important in a relationship, that husband and wife shouldn't try and stop each other from spending time with their friends. It's something that we all need to nurture the whole landscape of our relationships.
Let's take a couple more characters who you think can teach us lessons on how to live our lives today. Henry David Thoreau.
Yeah, Henry David Thoreau was this extraordinary 19th century American naturalist. And in the 1840s, he went off to live by himself in the woods of Western Massachusetts. He built a log cabin with his own hands. And he famously said that a man is rich in proportion to the number of things he can afford to let alone. And Thoreau was saying that we need to learn more simply and be less reliant on material pleasures. And I think if he were alive today, he would say to us, you know, you really need to cultivate buying your clothes secondhand, doing DIY, making things yourself, going to car boot sales, cutting down on all your needs or spending on too many luxurious items. And the reason he thought that was because if you can cut down your spending, you won't have to work as hard, and then you'll be left with the ultimate luxury, which is free time.
And the question of sorting out the difference between your needs and your wants. If you can do that, I mean, I want this, I want the new telly, but I actually don't need it.
Well, I think we need to conduct experiments in our lives. So over the next month, your listeners could simply keep a list of all the different things that they spend money on and label them as either needs or wants. And in the following month, try and half the amount you spend on those wants, on those desires. And you might actually feel somewhat liberated by the experience.
Now, Helen Keller, and most people are familiar with her life through the movies rather than anything else. Tell me why she is important.
Well, Helen Keller was best known for her struggle against her blindness and her deafness. In fact, in 1900, she was the first deaf-blind person to graduate from a university in the United States. But I think she's actually important because she reminds us how important it is to nurture all our various senses. She was someone who's extraordinarily sensitive. She could even tell all her own friends by their smell. She could differentiate them, probably not something that most people could do today. And she could, when she went into an art gallery, she was incredibly sensitive to the touch of the sculpture. She'd run her hands over them. And we live in incredibly visual culture. We're always snapping photos and looking at views. Helen Keller would say to us that we need to nurture all of our senses. For example, we need to, when we visit a new city, when we're on holidays, instead of walking around with your nose in a map, allow yourself to get lost and follow scent, you know, and allow a smell to take you to an old marketplace, or allow the sound of birdsong to help you discover a hidden garden. Mm-hmm. Helen Keller always said that most people walk around with their hands in their pockets. And what she meant was, we don't use all of our senses. And what a terrible thing. What a waste.
Yeah. She could distinguish between the velvet of the rose petal as distinct from the velvet of a ripe peach.
That's right. And I think most of us today probably couldn't do that or anything. We're not really as sophisticated in the way we use our senses. And we normally think of the senses as something that's very physical or biological, but actually we can learn to use them all better. I mean, 500 years ago, human beings were much more sensitive to smell than we are today. We live in a deodorized society. Now, of course, they were partly more sensitive to smell because there was so much disgusting sink in the sewers, but they were also more sensitive to beautiful smells. People would admire their smell of their lover, not just the look of their face, for instance. And I think we need to regain that kind of sensitivity that Helen Keller would have completely understood.
Now, another name that will not resonate, I suspect, with many people, but whose story is interesting, is that of Claiborne Paul Ellis.
He's an almost forgotten figure from history, but also one of the most important people in the history of US race relations, but also in the history of human belief. He was born in 1927 in the county of Durham, North Carolina. He was from a poor working class background. He worked as a janitor and in a garage. And he later became a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. He blamed African Americans, blamed black people for all his troubles. And something extraordinary happened to him almost exactly 50 years ago today, which is that he went to a community meeting and he was forced to be the head of a committee working together with a black civil rights activist who he hated called Ann Atwater. And what happened was that he actually realized Ann Atwater was a rather nice person and they shared a lot. They shared the oppression of poverty. And after the end of this meeting, he stood up in front of 1,000 people and he tore up his Ku Klux Klan membership card. And the lesson I think we can learn from that history is that one of the great ways to change our lives is through challenging our beliefs and prejudices. And we do it by talking to strangers and stepping out of our own shoes. I mean, Claiborne Paul Ellis later made friends with Ann Atwater, and she was with him till the day he died in a nursing home. And I think we need to step out into the world and go and cultivate our curiosity about strangers, go and have a conversation with a stranger once a week. That's the best way to learn about new ways of living.
Some of the comments coming in, Maria says, I have a wonder box of wise quotes and sayings, and one of them is by Basho, learn how to listen as things speak for themselves. And from Emma, as a relationship therapist, the concept of love is something that is regularly discussed between my clients and me. Your speaker's theory that there are even more possibilities of love may positively influence my future work. So there you are. Anyway, the book is called The Wonder Box, Curious Histories of How to Live. It's written by Roman Krznarik. Narik, I think, is the correct pronunciation. Roman, is it?
Krznarik?
That's right,
yep.
Okay.
Perfect.
And it is published by Profile Books. And Roman, thank you very much for joining us on our program today.